listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Laura Thompson. Laura Thompson is the author of several books, including the bestseller The Six, The Lives of the Mitford Sisters. Her biography of the great mystery writer Agatha Christie has just been published in the United States, and it's called Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life. Laura Thompson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Agatha Christie, she's, according to your books, other than the Bible and Shakespeare, she's the most read author in the world. And she's obviously very popular and entertaining author. But being popular doesn't necessarily mean that she's good. So let me ask, start with that question. Do you think Agatha Christie was a great writer?
That's such a good question because, well, great. She's not Tolstoy, you know. But with regard to detective fiction, I think she is the template. I think the quality of her imagination is absolutely extraordinary because she's so familiar to us. I think we almost take it for granted. It's a bit like the Beatles. You know, you kind of forget to think, God, how did someone write Eleanor Rigby? Or something? I mean, if you look at her notebooks and see the hell she put herself through to come up with those plots, and then almost the courtesy with which she offers them up to us, so seamless. No sign of workings out, if you like, you know, contained within that perfect geometry. And what I think about Agatha, she created, you know, some people, particularly here in the UK, will say, you know, she's not realistic. Well, of course she's not realistic. She's not remotely trying to be realistic. But I think she is true. I don't think any of her characters ever murder for a reason that we think, oh, God, no. No, 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 Agatha, don't like that one. That doesn't... There's always a tremendous sense of resolution. A bit like I call them fairy tales for adults, a little bit like that, that wonderful sense of, at the end, like you had as a child reading a fairy story. And that everything is actually fallen into place in the correct manner, which is incredibly good to read and very, very difficult. I don't know how she did it. I still don't know how she did it. And I also think what she did with the solution, you know, it's a murder that was actually a suicide, or it's a suicide that was a murder, or a policeman did it, or a child did it, or incredible, just almost conceptual, in a way that none of the others do. And she fitted the genre to perfection, and of course it wasn't the whole of her personality. Her personality was much more complicated than that. But I think she, so great... great within her own limits, if you like. Yeah, I do think she is. Yeah.
And in addition to writing as Agatha Christie, she wrote several books under another name.
Yeah, they were gold. My goodness, these Mary Westmacotts. There's six of them, and they really are the. You couldn't be more unlike an Agatha Christie. They are kind of like her catharsis in a way. Well, I think the detective stories were catharsis in another way, you know, tying life up, resolving things, making a perfect little package of it. But these Westmacotts are, well, it's any idea that came into her head, she sort of explores. They're like, you don't really get novels so much like that now. They're kind of written between 1930 and 1956, the last one. The middle of the 20th century when, you know, the state of the human, the human condition, examining the human condition in a very, not necessarily stylistically interesting, but just trying to get to the bottom of human nature in a way that now we're perhaps more interested in the style of a novel or... So they're quite, in some ways, they're quite gauche, and I can imagine a certain amount of literary snobbery about them. You know, they're called romantic novels. Well, they're certainly not romantic novels. I mean, one, Absent in the Spring, which she wrote in about a week. It was eating away at her. She wrote it during the Second World War when she was dead on her feet. She was working in a hospital, writing as Agatha Christie, and then she wrote this book. She really was, a writer by temperament. She just had to do it. And it's about a woman who's stranded in the desert. She must have got the idea during her travels. And is bereft of everything. No one to talk to. nothing to do, no book to read, and she examines herself with truth. She has to. And it's fantastic. It's fantastic. Absent in the Spring. I mean, it's gripping. How does she make that gripping? And then the end, which you wonder which way she'll go. Will she live with that truth or revert to her social self? And you don't know. And it's she's just got that gift, that narrative gift, the gift of readability, which is much rarer than perhaps is always acknowledged.
And she wrote under the Mary Westacott name even after it became known that she was Agatha Christie as well?
She did, but she wasn't keen. Because I think it was given away by the Sunday Times in 1949, and then two more did come out. But she was very upset about it. I think it was her. She was so private, so private. And she started writing them after the disappearance, which I'm sure we'll talk about, the 1926, when she disappeared and became a notorious woman, which nearly killed her. And I think one of them, Unfinished Portrait, which is came out in 1934, and it's all about that. It's all about her childhood, it's all about her first marriage, it's all about a version of the disappearance. Not factually true, but I think emotionally pretty much what she went through. I mean, to have done that, but she could never have done that under her own name. She always needed shields. The name Agatha Christie became a shield, you know, the matronly English lady having tea with the vicar and thinking of arsenic in the crumpets and all that, you know. She used that. Of course, she was nothing like that. And then she also used Mary Westmacott. And when it became exposed, I think she did go off it. But she would expose herself in her detective fiction. So, I mean, some of the best ones, which I think, again, are written in the aftermath of the disappearance. I mean, you take a book like... The books she wrote through the 30s, the early 40s, I think are... Oh, I think they're marvelous. If you look at them and think, okay, this plot can't happen. No one's going to run around a ship and pretend to shoot themselves in the leg and all that kind of stuff. Of course, no murder is going to be committed like that. We know that. But the truth behind the motivation of some of those books, a book like Five Little Pigs, which I think is her best, which is kind of, in a weird way, obliquely autobiographical about the disintegration of a marriage. And the beauty of that book, the way plot moves with character, I think is a masterpiece, really.
Well, in Five Little Pigs, the wife of the painter who is then charged with his murder, you're saying that represents her?
Well,
to a certain extent.
I don't know. I mean, it sounds so... She was so mysterious.
But you think there are aspects of that character?
There are aspects, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the same in Death on the Nile. Jackie de Belfort, when she seems to have been ditched by her man, and she sort of... She talks about love in a way that's... There's a sudden flash of profundity, I think, in the writing. Or another one, a very good one, Sad Cypress, when Eleanor's ditched by her man and she just thinks, oh God, none of this need have happened if only he hadn't met that girl. You know, there's a kind of, that sounds so banal the way I'm saying it, but there's a kind of honesty in there. And I think, as I say, her motivations have truth in them. I mean, some of her, it's amazing how sometimes she's seen over here as this, you know, this posh old lady, and poor old posh old ladies, they don't know anything about, they probably never had sex. Well, they must have had it once because she had a daughter and she must have known a bit about, you know, life, perhaps, poor old lady, but we'll put it into the television adaptations because she didn't really know. Well, she knew a hell of a lot, and she is, you know, a book like The Hollow, I remember reading that when I was probably about 13 and thinking, wow, these people are having an affair and there is no judgment here. It's just what happens. It's life. And I know that doesn't sound much when I say it, but to be non-judgmental about human nature is actually it's quite something, really. And again, it's so unlike the way we think of her. But I think because her plots are so brilliant, one forgets what is informing them. And I think a lot of wisdom is informing them. And some of that is, well, no, a lot of it is concentrated on within the personalities of her detectives. The old lady wisdom of Miss Marple, the observation, and the kind of sophisticated wisdom of Poirot. They're pure detective. Poirot has no life. Miss Marple doesn't have a personal life, but their omniscience is very satisfying to the reader. It's clear, you know.
Well, Laura Thompson, your book made me want to get deeper into Agatha Christie than I've ever had, because you talked about a book where there's a character who's a mystery writer who's saddled with a detective that she can't stand. And then, then you said there's one where it's all set in swinging London with all the mini skirts and hippies and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that you know, Third Girl, you know, you could probably say there's a bit of a falling off from the 1950s. Although, I say that, I mean, Endless Night, which she wrote in her late 70s, you know, it's really stunning. Really stunning. That's also kind of not so much swinging London, but she was very interested in the youth, the worship of youth that started to come along in her later life, you know. And I think, you know, again, it would be very simple to say, oh, well, she was old and what did she know? But she kind of did. She kind of did. And her young people, I find very interesting. The young man in Endless Night who just thinks, I want, I'll have, with very little conception of the notions of cause and effect or anything like that. I'm not saying all young people are like that, good Lord, but it's a type that I think she very much covered the 20th century. She some of her less read books, like a book like Destination Unknown, which is about communism, and her robust, again easy to denigrate attitude, was ideologies are inimical to human nature and therefore ridiculous. You know, you read that now and you think, gosh, that's quite prescient, actually. I like that book. Nobody reads it, I don't know. Well, obviously some people do, but it's I think it's a clever book. You know, I think her wisdom is of a kind that is reassuring, but not cozy, that awful word cozy, you know, reading them by the fire on a winter's day. She's more than that. She's more than that.
Do you think that her most popular books, which I guess would be And Then There Were None and Murder on the Orient Express, I guess mostly because they've been adapted from movies and things. Do you think that her most popular books are her best books necessarily?
Well, they're pretty good. I mean, And Then There Were None. Oh, my goodness. I mean, I know she went through real problems getting that plot, as you would, but again, you have no sense of that reading it, obviously, but oh God, I mean, that's so clever. It's genius, really. And they're similar in a way because they're both about the idea of natural justice versus legal justice, if you like. I mean, I won't say more because people may not, but it's I think she was very exercised by that. And this, again, I don't mean to overstate the case. She would have not overstated her own, although she had a good sense of her own worth, and rightly. But there's always the fundamentals underpinning her work are strong. And that's why even when she, you know, some of the things that happen in them can't possibly have happened in the real world, we kind of accept it because the fundamentals are strong. And I think something quite important is underpinning those books. And I also think the atmosphere of And Then There Were None. My God, the first time I read it, I was terrified. And how has she done it? I remember talking to P.D. James before she died, and she said, which he doesn't really describe, and yet you have this very, very strong sense of what she hasn't described. It's the English village of St. Mary Mead. I mean, how is she described? She's not really gone in for long descriptions and yet that has become some sort of archetypal English village, which would have bored her to death, incidentally, because she was very cosmopolitan. And, of course, her father was born in, grew up an American. He was a New Yorker. He was an Edith Wharton, upmarket New Yorker. And she visited every country in the world, and not pretty much. And she was very cosmopolitan and would have gone off her head in St. Mary Mead. But she knew it, and she knew how to evoke it. And there are English villages like that. Unbelievably, there really are.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. Tonight we're talking with Laura Thompson. She's the author of a biography of Agatha Christie. Her books are, as you were saying a minute ago, kind of a puzzle. And as soon as the puzzle is solved, usually, then that's the end of the book. I mean, sort of the last line of the book is the end of the story, is the end of the puzzle. But given that, do you think that there's reason to read a book again? Because obviously you're an Agatha Christie scholar, Laura Thompson. But,
oh, that's lovely.
But do you think other people, people like me, should we read a book again, even if we saw the movie or we know the story? Are there benefits to a reread?
Yeah, it's a good question. P.G. Woodhouse, who was a big admirer of hers, always said, "I can read them again because the characters are so good." Now, that, of course, is contrary to the usual view, which is, once you know, what's the point? But, all these people who went to see Murder on the Orient Express, the Kenneth Branagh one,
yes,
cannot believe that none of those people knew the solution.
Right. Didn't they read the book?
But they must have, because a lot of older people went, so presumably they had seen the 1974.
Yeah, that's right. The year 76 or something, right?
74.
Uh-huh, right.
I cannot believe that people went just to find out who did it. I think you can read them again. I'm not saying you should read them again. There's tremendous pleasure in seeing how she's, where she's planted, how she's, and I still see things. Murder of Roger Ackroyd, I thought, oh God, she's kind of let us know who that is there. The when she sort of gives you a clue in plain sight and to see how she's done that, given you this clue, and at the same time made you ignore it or made you not see the significance, that's clever and interesting to read. But I do reread them. I do reread them. just because it is like that almost childlike satisfaction of feeling a resolution work itself through, the delight in the way she speeds up toward the last sort of three chapters or something, and you can feel it. But I reread them they're not the only thing I read. But to relax, or if I was writing a book, I might think, oh, Agatha, it'll have to be Agatha because, I'm not up to whatever, Dostoevsky or, I like detective fiction. She's not the
obviously.
Only one I like, but.
Well, yeah, actually, I think one of my favorite parts of the book is when you compare her to all of the other detective fictions, and obviously, you've read all of their work as well because you make interesting comparisons that
thank you. Well, I enjoyed doing that. Someone like Dorothy L. Sayers, I don't know, is she known in America? I think she's terrific. Much more stylish writer than Agatha, but she writes linear, if you like. This happens and that happens and that. Agatha writes geometric, to my mind. It's like a geometric shape, and there's something incredibly satisfying about that. About And then if you turned it round the other way, you'd see all the workings out and you'd see all what's gone into it. But she, and I also am interested in the idea that Poirot is not, like the other guys, like P.D. James' guy is incredibly attractive and a poet and basically much too good to be a detective. Lord Peter Wimsey is, like, incredibly ridiculously rich and incredibly sexy and knows everything. Other than being a detective. Poirot is pure detective. Pure detective. She felt no need to prove herself above the genre, as it were. And I kind of like that. And I like the way she writes. I like the sudden splashes of colour that make her not so much deep, but very alive on the page. Poirot is very vivid on the page. He's not a character, but he's vivid.
Does Miss Marple and Poirot, do they exist in the same world? Do they ever meet in any of the books? I know they did in a movie, but do they ever actually appear in the same book?
Oh, God. Did they really meet in a movie?
There's one movie where they're both in it, I believe. I could be wrong, but I think there's one.
No, I think you might be right, actually.
Yeah.
I haven't seen all those films, I'm afraid. I've seen like the Margaret Rutherford ones that she really didn't like, but they do actually inhabit different worlds. That's quite true, because in her notebook you'll see that she a couple of the, like, Cat Among the Pigeons was originally going to be a Marple, and then she put him in it instead. I think she found him. I know there's this thing that he got on her nerves and what have you. I think there might have been a bit of publicity about that. It was a publicity idea as much as anything. I think she found him more, you know, he could move around. He was a cosmopolitan. She could put him anywhere. Miss Marple is, although she did in later life go to the Caribbean, but she is of her world. It's a small world, and that's the point of her. When she says village life is very much like any other life, it's a microcosm. She's onto something there. It's quite true. The village where I grew up, the things that went on, you know.
was there a lot of murder? I mean, that's...
desire to do so, I think. That's the thing about Agatha. Of course, murder doesn't happen in that way and to that extent, but the desire to do it, the desire to commit murder is there in, well, I would say all of us at some point. Of course, you know, she always says we're all capable of committing murder. I'm not sure that's true, but the motivations are universal. Certainly in that particular village where I grew up, my God, I can think of a few that could have happened, didn't. But that idea, and also she's very much writing about her grandmother's in Miss Marple. She grew up in a kind of matriarchy, really. Her father was this very smart, upmarket, lovely man, but he was a gentleman of leisure. He never did anything in his life. He just walked through Torquay, where she grew up, and bought things, and eventually spent all the money. Her mother was a very forceful, dynamic personality, and encouraged her to write, wanted her to write. And her grandmother, and in fact it was a great aunt, they were sisters. The grandmother was her father's stepmother. But they were, she grew up with this kind of sound of female intuition, wise intuition in her ears. And I think she replicated that thing of always think the worst about people, which is Miss Marple's mantra, which sadly I think is probably true. She grew up with that. She wasn't necessarily a wise woman in her own life, Agatha, not at all, really. But she grew up hearing this and the sound of the authoritative female servants, because she loved servants. I know we think that's a bit much these days, but she had massive respect for them. That's how she grew up. She grew up with a poetic side to her. She liked imagining that the house was twice the size and full of rooms she didn't know about, and that the garden was full of wild horses and things. But at the same time, she liked the reality of these women, these sensible, sensible women. And one aspect of this went in the Mary Westmacott's, and the other went in the detective fiction. To be glib about it, my God, there's much more to it than that. But, you know.
Well, do you think... I don't know. I don't think it would affect me. I mean, she spent her life, you know, thinking about ways to kill people. do you think it affected her that she had all these thoughts of killing and jealousy and greed?
Well, writers do. I mean, not so much the killing. I don't think she was interested in murder at all, really. She never, as we know, she never dwelt on details of murder. She very much just liked the film. If you hear this tape of her, oh my God, it's so funny. She's talking to Lord Snowden, who I think is now, you know, because he's a character in The Crown, married to Princess Margaret. She's talking to him when she's quite old. He went to interview her, and I found this tape of it. She sounds so grand, it's untrue, much more than the Queen. She's, unbelievable. And she hated the film of Endless Night, the one with, I think it's great, the one with Britt Ekland, because one of the murder scenes was much too much for her. She thought it was dreadful, sort of pornographic. And if you think about her book, she never, the murder itself is never...
It happens off screen, generally, right?
Kind of. I mean, she'll kill off children, and you then move on. She was very. That's one of her paradoxes. She was kind of in love with her own childhood, but kind of exasperated by children. Including her own.
Her own, right.
Yeah, a little bit. She wasn't maternal. She was one of those people who was temperamentally a daughter, I think. But, no, I don't think murder in itself... I found loads of letters where she'd write to doctor friends and things to find out about the properties of poison. Could I kill someone off with this? But it's the... And, of course, she worked as a dispenser... and famously, that's how she got the idea for her first, you know, mysterious affair at Stiles, because of properties of strychnine. But that was more of a, oh, can this be of use to me in sorting out a plot? The feelings, the motivations, yeah, the jealousy. You know, most of her murders are done for money or gain, and I think, that's true. Most murder is almost certainly done for gain. So, in a sense, there's an impersonal quality to those books, I think. I think she could... aspects of her life would flash into them. Her own opinions would flash into them. At the same time, I think they were as impersonal as she could get them. I think that was part of it for her, you know.
Although some of the books that we were talking about earlier that you think are her best are ones in which the motive for murder is quite different, right?
Yes, that's true. That's true. But then she would write something like Five Little Pigs, and around it are, well, N or M, which is like a wartime spy book, and Death Comes as the End, which is set in ancient Egypt. They're not all. I do think that she. It's hard to explain. They kind of. It's a way of, like, she would suddenly make a reference to somebody who disappeared. She does that a couple of times. She, of course, you know, did, and it sort of wrecked her life, but. She will suddenly make a reference to someone who disappeared, lost her memory and disappeared. It's almost like she's using the impersonality of the genre to put these things in a way that makes them safe. It's hard to explain. She can write about herself because within that genre, it's completely safe because the genre itself is so all-encompassing. The Wes McCotsett's completely different. She eviscerated herself, which she also felt the need to do. But that was not a public act, in her view, because she was protected by the pseudonym. And it really, you know, when she wrote the most exposing ones, it really was not known who she was. But there's an arm's length quality to a detective story for her that I think she found protective, if you see what I mean.
I do. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Laura Thompson. She's the author of Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life. Let's talk about 1926. We've been alluding to it. So that was the pivotal year in her life, the worst year in her life, I guess you'd say.
Oh, nothing really bad had happened to her up till that point. So she was 35, 36. She was born in September 1890. And so up till that point, her father had died when she was very young, 11. But I think although she was terribly fond of him, her mother was everything to her, really. I think her mother was the most important person in her life. Very, very strong personality, the mother. But because she was the last of three, Agatha, and there was a huge gap between her, she had a brother and a sister, and then there was this big sort of 10-year gap, and I think that made her, the relationship with her mother was, very intense. And her mother died in April 1926, and then she'd been married to Artie Christie since 1914, very attractive man, and her mother had said, I'm not sure you should marry him, Agatha. I think he might be ruthless, which he was, but she overrode her mother, which was terribly unusual because she usually did everything Clara said, and Clara was usually right. But she married him. He was flying in the war, you know. It was all very, the pressure of the war, I think. It was a bit like Romeo and Juliet, you know, the pressure of the feud heightens emotions. They got married on Christmas Eve 1914. It was very, very, oh gosh, they had no money, but he was so insistent and so attractive, and she really did fall for him. And I think he did for her. She kept all his love letters. They're very, very passionate, very, you know, hard to resist. But then by 1926, because today we would think, you know, a marriage of 12 years is doing pretty well, and maybe, you know, we don't necessarily expect to be married forever. She did, and in some way she saw it coming. In her, she wrote poems that sort of hinted that she saw it coming, and in another way she... You know, when you think something's true, and in another way you're just playing with the idea. But he went away in the summer of 1926, and she didn't go with him. She stayed at her family home, turning out her mother's things, which is, of course, unbearably painful. And then he came back in August, and she thought he was going to sort of make everything all right for her. And he said, I've fallen in love with another woman and I'd like a divorce. And I think the double blow of the mother, because I don't know that he'd have dared to do it if the mother was still alive. He was very wary of her. And the double blow of the mother and the husband, I think, well, she had a complete breakdown. The only thing that consoled her was her dog, which I kind of understand. Her daughter, I'm afraid, who was seven at that point, she was not maternal, and the daughter was very, very close to Archie. So they were living in this big, nice, nice house, but slightly, not a a friendly house, very dark looking, and nowhere near anyone she wanted to be or anything like that. And I, and he just stayed away for weekends, never came home. She begged him, never came back. He just wouldn't. He was very, very obdurate. And I think he thought she would be all right without him, because by that point she was nothing like she became, but quite a successful writer, and had a life of her own. I think he thought she'd be okay. Whereas the new girl, the one he was having the thing with, was much younger, beautiful, every cliche that you care to name, and sort of dependent on him. But when she disappeared, this famous 11-day disappearance, I think the whole point is that she did not intend to disappear for 11 days. She was not in her right mind, but she was still thinking, and she was thinking as Agatha Christie. So it was a kind of plot. I think she did think about suicide. Well, her daughter more or less said that to me. But she didn't. She then changed course, and I think tried to, as it were, write a new story, if you like. It's kind of the ultimate Agatha Christie, because there are areas that cannot be solved. But she abandoned a car quite near where Archie was staying the weekend with the girlfriend was there. Abandoned a car, and in it were clues. There was an old driving license. There was a coat, etc. And then she wrote a letter to her brother-in-law, with whom she was very friendly, Archie's brother. And she said, "I'm going up north to get away." And basically, that is exactly what she did. And I think she thought the brother-in-law would get on to his brother and say, "Look, you need to sort this out with Agatha, etc., etc." But none of that happened, because it became a police affair. And then the police started talking to the press. And then Archie was going to be arrested for murder. And then it became, Agatha's dead. There were these great hunts for her body. She'd committed suicide, etc., etc. The police were outside the house all the time. It became this massive, massive, massive tabloid sensation. And, of course, it had always been her private affair that then she had not foreseen would become this massive thing that was designed more than anything to make sure that Archie never came back to her. And that's what's so cruel about it.
Because that's the opposite of what she wanted.
Yeah. When he finally did go and find her in this hotel, it was over. The idea that it was a publicity stunt is just crazy.
Saw in the papers that her husband was being accused of her murder and so on, why didn't she just say, "Oh, I'm going to go home"?
Well, he wasn't openly accused of her murder. That was all going on behind the scenes. He was, all that was appearing in the press was that he was, they thought she was dead, and he was giving interviews to the press that weren't very, he wouldn't know how to talk to a journalist or anything without making a fool of himself, but there was nothing openly in the press saying this man's about to be arrested. I can see how some people would say, "Oh, well, she was loving it. She was loving him being in, being a sort of figure of public excoriation, etc., etc." That I do not believe at all. I think she was in a sort of fugue state, if you like, waiting for it to end, but in a strange way, almost like it was like she became a different person. She sort of drifted through that life. I don't think she was necessarily even unhappy. She was staying in this hotel, drifting through the town, going into meals, etc., reading. I don't think she was in her right mind. I think the loss of her mother would have almost itself tipped her over the edge. And then for him to come in and say, "Oh, by the way, you're going to lose me as well," I think it did sort of kill her in a metaphorical way. She wasn't, and then she remade herself. She remade herself as Agatha Christie. She married again. She she was a religious woman, and she sort of thought she'd committed the sin of despair, and she remade her life, and she made a wonderful life for herself. But she never got over him, and her daughter told me that. She said if I went to see him, I couldn't ever tell my mother. A friend told me if you mentioned his name or something, that was the end. I don't think she ever got over him. And then she immediately, well, not immediately, but she started writing about it in those Westmacotts. I think they were all about him in a way. You know, love, the illusion of love, but you still go on feeling it, even though it's an illusion. And her son-in-law met him in much later life, and he said to me, he was so dull, you know, he was so unlike Agatha, because she never had time to find that out. She was kind of stuck with him as he, you know, this glamorous man who didn't want her anymore. I think it was the shock. You don't really get over shock, I don't think. Not really. There's a part of you that doesn't get over it, I think.
And she was like, avoided any publicity of any kind from that point on. She didn't do interviews or book tours or any of those things.
Oh, well, they were terrible to her. I mean, those papers, you know, we think of that as a kind of modern phenomenon. You know, flaying someone alive in the papers. Oh my God, the way they wrote about her, because they were so sympathetic because old poor Mrs. Christie's killed herself. They never said, "Oh, the husband's having an affair, that's why," or not necessarily an affair, but you know, as good as. They never said why she might have killed herself. The papers, they just sort of said she was unhappy and hint, hint, hint. But when she was found to be alive in a hotel, comfortable, this very nice hotel in Harrogate, which is like, you know, really, you know, where middle-class ladies go, she became this massive, massive national hate figure for the crime of being alive. As did he, in a way, because he gave this speech to the press saying, my wife has lost her memory, she knows nothing. And, of course, nobody believed that for a second. And then it became this theory that she'd done it as a stunt to promote her books. Absolute rubbish. And then it became she'd done it to upset him, possibly get him arrested for murder. That wasn't what she wanted him back. She didn't want that. She was, if I say she was thinking, but not thinking in her right mind, that's the best I can sort of... But because she's Agatha Christie, there's a plot going on. But then he left. They went to her sister's house, and he then left. And I think that really was the worst bit of all. She was just there with the daughter, and it was, oh, you know, bleak. I thought it was very upsetting. Because to disappear, you know, if you want someone to still be in love with you, there's actually nothing you can do about it, I don't think. But, you know, one might say, oh, I'll disappear and I'll make him sorry. But to do it, to go through with it, what an extraordinary person she must have been. Extreme, extreme, extreme person to have done that. And that place where she left the car and everything, I mean, I went there, I sort of almost reenacted it. That is a very scary place. That is not something you do out of some petty motive. You do that because you are in absolute despair. You know, it's black, you can't see a thing, it's vertiginous, it's scary. And she was in despair. I felt no doubt about that when I went to that place. And of course thereafter, it was always liable to come up in the papers, oh, Mrs. Christie, the disappearing, you know, and she was, questions were asked about her in Parliament, how much money had been wasted on looking for this ludicrous woman. And for someone like her, who had also lost her husband because of all this, to remake herself took a lot of strength, really. And that was how she met the second husband, Max, because she decided to use travel as a way of rebuilding her personality, I suppose. And she did find a kind of escape in it. And she went to Baghdad, which in those days, unbelievable to think of, was like a sort of colonial outpost full of English, you know, oh, Agatha, come to tea at the cricket. Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. And there was an archaeologist. She'd always been interested in archaeology. It was fashionable. And this guy, this Max Mallowan, who was 14 years her junior, and I think he saw quite a good thing in Agatha, really. There was a lady who would, he could rebuild her confidence, and she would bankroll his career. It sort of suited them both, really, I think.
And then, of course, you know, so many of her books were about various world locations. And yeah, it really is a complex life. I'm not surprised to hear that you walked in her footsteps, because you do your best to solve the puzzle of her mysterious life in the book, Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life. And the author, my guest, Laura Thompson, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
That closes the book on this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Laura Thompson. She's the author of Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.